the might and power of the dark waves of the North Sea, was another battlefield of the Great War, another old front line. And here we discover the story of one ship and its crew that had a very different kind of war. When we study what the old front line means, it's not just about the war on the Western Front, not just about the war on land. Often we look at the battle beneath that land, the war underground, or above it, with the war in the air. And while the Western Front stretched over 450 miles from Switzerland to the coast on the Channel and the North Sea, I guess that's the point we're making here, that there was this naval flank, even on the Western Front, and operations like Gallipoli and Salonika can't be understood without reference to a naval component. And the naval side of the war, often overlooked, perhaps forgotten, I kind of hasten to use that phrase, nevertheless saw nearly 45,000 men killed serving with some aspect of the Royal Naval Forces. And of those, two-thirds of them, the sea is their grave, and they're commemorated on the great memorials at Plymouth and Portsmouth and Chatham. More than 500 vessels were lost at sea while serving with the Navy. And once we take into account the navies of other nations, Germany, France, the Austro-Hungarian Empire, Russia, then we can understand that the war at sea is vital to our understanding of the Great War. So in this episode, we look at an obscure aspect of the war at sea, but it helps us shed light on this subject and understand what the experience of another kind of old front line, one washed by the waves, deep as fathoms, and where whole communities of men on a ship could disappear beneath those dark waters forever. And I'm sure that this is a subject we'll return to. But for now, we look at the story of one ship and the fate of its crew, HMS India. Welcome to a slightly different Trench Chat on the Old Frontline podcast. We've not as yet really covered much of the war at sea, and we can't really separate that war at sea from the war at land. So I'm pleased to be able to do a chat finally relating to this subject. And I'm really pleased to be joined by historian Rebecca Clark, who has looked at the story of one ship, and more importantly, the crew of that ship, and we're going to hear more of their story now. So thanks for joining us, Rebecca, and welcome to the Old Front Line.
Thanks so much, Paul. It's lovely to be here.
So this is, I've had a look at your website, and we're going to put links to that on the podcast website so people can find that. It's a really interesting story. What kind of brought you to research this particular subject?
So my father-in-law, when I met my husband, I was a teenager and would visit his house, and on the wall of my father-in-law's study were four cuttings of a birch tree, from the trunk of a birch tree, and they were hand-painted. And on them, there was details of from the First World War. So they have painted on them the dates of the war. They were from Norway. And I started asking questions and was told that my husband's grandfather had been interned in Norway during World War One, and I thought that was very interesting. I'd not heard of that kind of thing before, but then sort of set it aside. And then I've become the family archivist for my husband's family. He had three great aunts who kept everything, and I'm not overstating it by saying everything. I've found menus from 1931. And so they kept letters, and I was aware there were some letters that were written by his grandfather from the camp in Norway. And then My father-in-law became reinterested in the whole project about 15 years ago. A wreck had been discovered off the Western Australian coast, and it made him decide to look to see if anybody had ever tried to find where the wreck was of the ship his father had been on. And he found some letters of his father's on the internet being sold. And we were not aware that these letters were in the public. And then we started talking about it. He came over here in about 2015, and we decided to head to the National Archives and check out the files that I'd found there on the ship as well. And it sort of all snowballed from there. The files at the National Archives are really interesting. They involve letters. We found a letter from his grandfather in the files as well. So, yeah, this will all start to make sense the more I unravel the story, but that's sort of what kicked me into it.
And the ship concern was HMS India.
Yes.
I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about that ship and kind of how it came to be in naval service.
Sure. So HMS India was a P&O passenger cruiser. She'd been doing the trips between England and Australia. She was built in 1896, I think it is. And so she was a steamer. Yeah, she was launched 13th of April 1896 as SS India and sailed between Britain and India and then further afield to Australia. She was a fairly large passenger steamer, accommodating over 300 first-class passengers and over 200 second-class with 400 crew. Twin funnels, but a single screw, so only one prop, but steamed at regularly at 18 knots. So she was a fast ship. And she was commandeered with around half of P&O's fleet to become a part of the Merchant Navy in late 1914, they started that. So she was put into what was called the 10th Cruiser Squadron. And the 10th Cruiser Squadron had been put together at the start of the war with a group of ships called the Edgar class steamers. But they proved really unable to handle the work they were doing in the North Sea, which was challenging on many, many counts. And steamers like India were brought in because they could travel far distances. They were used to being at sea for a long period of time. They could cruise at least 10 knots. They could be divided into watertight compartments. They had good protection for coal. So they converted ships like India, adding guns, range finders, plating the hulls with steel to protect engines, removing glass and furniture, and adding in things like sick bays and operating theatres. So all of this was done. She was launched from Scilly's Wharf in April 1915 and headed to the 10th Cruiser Squadron, which was operating out of the top of Scotland and over the top of the North Sea.
And I guess on the outbreak of war, the crew of SS India and what became HMS India would have been merchant seamen. And was there a kind of transition between their knowledge of the ship and the Navy taking control of it?
There are a few, I think, who stayed on or who had been merchant navymen. But my grandfather-in-law was someone who had been working in the shipyards in Yarrow Engineering in Glasgow. And so he had volunteered and was put into the RNVR. So he became a volunteer. And so there was a big mix of people on the ship of the over 300 crew that there were. There was a real mix. They had some of the old folk who'd been pulled back out of retirement to serve again, right down to the youngest was a boy who was 16. And so, yeah, they had the full range, the full gamut of people on board.
And these ships that operated in the North Sea at that time, we kind of think of Jutland of being the only kind of naval operation in the entire war sometimes. But the North Sea was an area of intense naval activity throughout the conflict.
Yeah, so what they were trying to do was, there was a number of things, but the main one was to stop German ships heading into Narvik in the top of Norway there. And Narvik was known for its coal, and that was what they were trying to stop, was ships going in to coal up. And the protection of the channel went from the very top of Norway to the very bottom of, you know, France there and down towards Spain. So they really were protecting the whole part. And there are some, you know, in 1915, over 3,000 ships were chased by the 10th Cruiser Squadron and other ships, intercepted and examined, and 743 were found to be carrying contraband. Now, contraband changed almost on a weekly basis, depending on what the English government decided at the time was contraband. And they just kept adding things on. So it was often hard for the ship's captains to remember what was actually contraband that week. But that they really were trying to, even in the early days in 1915, to stop all import of things or movement of goods into Germany.
But I guess the Navy War then, the Naval War, became kind of an extension of an economic war against Germany to try and prevent it, almost kind of starve it of these resources.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
And I think that's kind of a link that people perhaps forget, how important that was. I mean, the Battle of the Atlantic, the famous Battle of the Atlantic, World War II, was all about getting resources, and the Germans were trying to prevent that. And kind of this is what we were doing during this period in the Great War.
Yeah. Yeah. And from a very early stage, you know, it started as war broke out, they were getting these cruisers up and trying to stop Germany. Yeah, refueling in many ways, whether it be food, whether it be goods, whether it be coal. Yeah.
And HMS India is kind of in the North Sea in this period in 1915.
Yeah, so she went straight up. So she sailed from Scilly's Wharf in London and went straight up and around to Glasgow, where she recoaled and then headed out into the North Sea on her first forays and first work out there. She did that until it was only late June. She got a couple of months in, and then disaster struck.
Because the enemy that they were fighting was the German Navy, not just with surface vessels, but this was the first war in which vessels operating beneath the surface, submarines, yeah, U-boats, were very much part of battle.
Absolutely. And the English severely underestimated the damage that U-boats could do. They sort of thought it was a bit of a gimmick, I think, to start with. They were really under the impression that it wasn't anything to be super worried about. And I suppose the Lusitania put an end to those thoughts. But certainly, this was something they were battling with the whole time up in Norway, and the 10th Cruiser Squadron were dealing with constant, if not attack, surveillance by U-boats.
And this took HMS India on, you know, it's kind of, excuse the pun, a collision course with this new type of naval warfare, really.
Yep, yeah. They'd sighted them a number of times, and they avoided one torpedo attack in the 3 months that they'd been at sea. They always travelled with two trawlers, and the trawlers kept an eye out as well. And they had, you know, all these tactics they used, zigzagging, they'd change course, they tried to be as unpredictable as possible, they'd vary their speeds, all of these things to try and avoid U-boat detection and then attack. But the 8th of August saw the end of that.
And what happened on the 8th of August 1915?
Sure. So I'm going to read to you from Sub-Lieutenant Alltree's report, and this was a report he wrote for the Admiralty. And he says, in accordance with your orders, I beg to make an additional report of the sinking of HMS India and the arrival of survivors at Helgvær Island. On August 8th, HMS India was steaming at 56 revolutions, 14 knots, heading south-southwest to head off Swedish steamer. Lookout reported, submarine on starboard bow. Looking in the direction, I saw a track of a torpedo about 300 yards distant. At the same time, Commander Kennedy ran on the bridge and ordered, "Hard sport, full speed ahead," which orders were immediately carried out by navigator and myself. I also sounded war alarm. Torpedo struck the ship, in my opinion, below number 3 starboard gun. Orders were given by Commander to send messages for assistance, as vessel had heeled over to port about 10 degrees and was going down by the stern. Commander gave the order to abandon ship. I went into number 2 cutter and found her ready for lowering and apparently full. I then got into the boat, which was lowered by Chief Gunner Byrne and a seaman. Great difficulty was experienced in getting away from the ship, as she was still going through the water at about 10 knots. All other boats from port side, with the exception of Port Whaler, capsizing in water. India was sinking rapidly by the stern, bow being lifted right out of the water, and guns being carried away. Vessel then broke in two by after well deck and sank rapidly. Torpedo had struck ship at 5:41 p.m. and she disappeared at about 5:46 p.m.
Wow, that was quite a rapid end.
An amazingly rapid end. She went down in 5 minutes.
And what kind of casualties were there on the ship?
So there were around 160 casualties, and then around just over 215 survivors. But there were only two lifecraft that managed to get away from the ship. The others were taken down with the ship. So those two lifecraft headed to the Halagveer Islands, leaving everybody else in the water, including my grandfather-in-law.
Wow.
And some of them were there for 3 hours before rescue. So it was the North Sea. It's quite a way offshore. It's about 6 miles off. It's very deep. No one will ever dive to this wreck. And yeah, it took quite a while to get rescue boats to them. So there are stories of them singing Tipperary to keep their spirits up. And there's another report from one of the other men on board who talks quite graphically about seeing one of the writers of the ship clinging onto a bit of wreckage and then just slipping away, not being able to hold on anymore.
Yes, because I mean, the sea, I guess, would have been covered in the kind of flotsam and jetsam of what was left of the vessel, and these men, that's all they had.
Yep. Yeah, they were sitting on doors and whatever they could. No, this is skipping ahead a bit. I've managed to get in contact with over 30 family members of men who were on the ship, but not one of them has told the story of how they survived.
So they were in the water for a long time. Some were eventually picked up, I guess, but not all.
Yeah. So we had the men who were in the lifecraft, and then we had two boats come and collect the remaining men. So we had a boat called the Andenis, and then we had another boat called the Gotteland. And those who arrived on the Gotteland, I'm trying to make sure I get this right. It was the Saxon and the Gotteland. Those who were saved by the Gotteland were given the option to go back to England. Those who were saved by the Saxon were saved by a belligerent boat and were interned in Norway. So that was the thing, and it went back and forwards between the Admiralty, between the Foreign Office, and between the authorities in Norway as to how they managed this. But the Hague Convention said that if you were on a belligerent boat and you were in the waters of a neutral country, then the neutral country had the right to intern you and keep you away from the war. Those that were on the Gotland were allowed to return because they were rescued by a Norwegian boat. Those that were on the Saxon, because it was an English boat, it was considered belligerent. It was a boat that could be used for war. They were kept.
So a sizable group of the crew then that survived the sinking of the ship ended up in Norway, which, as you've mentioned, was a neutral country.
Yes.
So kind of what happened next then?
Okay, so we had about 110 in total, just over, who had either rowed themselves to safety or who were on the Saxon, the trawler Saxon. And Commander Kennedy was actually given the opportunity to put these men on the Gotland and let them go. To leave them on the Saxon, not put them under shore at all, and they could sail back. Many of them were naked. Many of them were injured. Many of them were very, of course, shaken, traumatized. And there was no food on this boat. There was no water. And he just said, I can't. We're going to have to stay. So they were removed from the boat, checked over. They buried some of the men that had been found or brought in. And then they were taken to a temporary camp just off Bodø. They were there for about a week and a half. And then they were put on another boat and sailed down the coast, where they were then popped on a train and taken to Jorstadmen, which is just near Lillehammer. And they were put there into an army camp that was already a training camp that was then turned into an internment camp. And they arrived there about, I think it was about the 22nd of September, so about 15 days after the torpedo attack.
And I guess this must have taken the Norwegians a bit by surprise because, you know, as you said, there was not a camp to send them to. They weren't expecting to be effectively taking prisoners of war, being a neutral country, but yet they've got caught up in it.
Yeah, I think it did probably. I think they were amongst the first. It sort of gained, not in popularity, I suppose, but there became more and more camps as the war went on. But this was fairly early days. We're not even a year into war here. And yeah, the first camp was just literally a series of tents that had been erected to put these men in for the temporary camp. And the second one they had to, my grandfather-in-law writes, of the barbed wire going up to keep them all in. So it had to be turned into a secure camp.
So they're kind of following, as you mentioned, that the kind of the convention of the time, which was to not allow these men to return to fight. And they're interning them for the war. It's kind of, a slightly different status to British sailors or soldiers being captured on a battlefield or at sea and being interned by the Germans. But nevertheless, these men are kind of not free to do what they want, are they? They are effectively prisoners.
Yeah, I mean, I bring this up in my book, and when I've spoken at public events, this comes up a bit. They were kept as prisoners, yes. And listen, I think like the Isle of Man and other places that were operating internment camps at the time, the better behaved you were, the more you were allowed to do by the Norwegians. And then we look at the difference between the men and the officers. So the men were interned within the barbed wire. The officers weren't. The officers were in a hotel for a while and in a guest house. And then Commander Kennedy found a lovely big house, and we've found receipts for his furs and cigars and booze and all the rest. And other officers were in a woman's guest house. She ran this guest house and she put them all up in there. And they'd go into camp for 2 weeks at a time, the lesser officers. Commander Kennedy didn't. And they'd have to stay there for 2 weeks and be sort of the responsible officers there, and then they'd swap out and go and live out in the community again. But the men were behind barbed wire. And as time went on, my grandfather-in-law learnt to ski while he was there. But he points out in one of his letters, he sent a photo home, and he points out in one of his letters that what you might not see is the man with the gun who's standing behind us. Standing behind the photographer, so you see us with our skis, but we're always followed by the man with the gun.
So the Norwegians weren't kind of unkind to them, but there was still, you know, kind of there was still a stick in their hand, as it were.
I don't think they were unkind. Certainly not undeservedly. There were some men there who, as with any situation like this on this ship, you had men of different experiences, of different educational levels. And, you know, my grandfather-in-law spent his time woodworking. His sisters sent him tasks, so writing certificates for them for the schools that they, so doing artwork for them and things like that. Often he said he spent a lot of time smoking. But other men found it very difficult to fill their time. And if they were allowed out, they'd go out and drink and then come back rowdy. And so there was disciplinary measures that were put in place at times for those men, and you know, some of them were jailed, so taken to another place because of poor behavior. And so I think it's like probably any situation like that, if you're able to respect the situation that you're in and behave, then yes, life was made easier for you. If you didn't, then you'd suffer the consequences. Saying that, towards the end of 1918, towards the end of the war, it was a Swiss professor, doctor, who came up with the term barbed wire syndrome. And when you read the letters that we've got from my grandfather-in-law, you can very much see this sense of despondency and isolation and lack of hope. And, you know, one man went mad and killed himself in an asylum. And, you know, there's the thought that, yes, they were safe from war. They didn't. Absolutely, they were. But I think all of us now, and, you know, I wrote this in my book, who've been through lockdown, perhaps we now have a greater understanding of being denied your liberty through no fault of your own, how that can wear on you. And, you know, at one point my grandfather-in-law says, you know, if he had a dose of strychnine, he doesn't know what he would do. He doesn't like to think what he would do. And so, I think that's what I've brought out from this, is that the not all men stayed. There were men who were sent home for repatriation for varying health issues, and a few for mental health issues, but not many. But those who did stay the full, you know, three and a bit years, 3 years and full 5 months, yeah.
To spend over 3 years there is a big chunk of a man's life.
It is.
And, you know, like you said, with kind of COVID, we all kind of found it difficult just to kind of be contained for weeks stroke months during that period. So to be locked up in a camp where, although you're being treated reasonably well, you can't really live a normal life, it must have been terrible. I mean, I'm not surprised there were mental health issues with the people that were there.
And, you know, there's no Facebook, there's no FaceTime, there's no social media, there's, you know, there's nothing. And listen, the mail service was astounding. Astounding. I think the shortest time we've counted was a 4-day period from a letter leaving the UK to arriving in the camp in Norway, faster than it'd go now. You know, mail was amazing, as I'm sure you know, during World War One. So that was brilliant. But they were allowed to send 2 letters a week. They could receive mail in. But then, you know, my grandfather-in-law had trouble finding things to write about. And he'd say, I've sort of got nothing left to say, and all these people are writing to me, and I've got 2 letters. So he wrote to one sister mainly, one of his sisters, and he'd often say, this is not a circular, when he was needing to really express how lonely he was. And the letters that were allowed to be shared around between the rest of the family, he would have a lighter tone to.
But did they have to find their kind of own routine then? The Norwegians didn't ask them to do anything. They just contained them.
I can't. In the beginning, yes. Towards the middle of 1916, they started finding work for those who wanted it outside of the camp. So there are 2 instances of my grandfather-in-law working on the railway, on the Dovrebanen. So, yeah, in 1916, he went to Hjørken and he worked there. And then in 1918... from about mid-year, about June, July, to the very end of the war. He was up in Oppdal when the end of the war was announced. He was working on the construction of the railway and with a small team of men. And other men, some of the junior officers or stewards of officers and things like that, were given jobs in some of the government offices around, or in the consulates and places like that. So there'd be little jobs here and there for people. But if you hadn't learnt Norwegian, then that could prove to be problematic for you. They had to take it in turns sometimes to cook, but a lot of the other time, no, there didn't seem. They played sport. There was a soccer team that did very well and was known to be, and they'd allow them out of camp to play the local teams. But yeah, I can't find any activities or other things that were set up by the Norwegians. The other things were sort of put in place by the English.
And I guess they tried to kind of continue to run it as if they were still on a ship, I guess, with the kind of officers and senior kind of petty officers and so on kind of running the show, trying to keep a level of discipline, I would guess.
Absolutely. The officers, I've been in contact with one granddaughter of one of the officers, and she had said to me, listen, I've got a photo album that my grandfather gave me, and I just can't understand. There's all these pictures of women and what seems to be parties. And I said, well, Yep, that sounds right. That was certainly going on. The officers seemed to be having quite the time of it. Commander Kennedy married a Norwegian lady in February of 1916. They'd been in the country 6 months. And he was the first, but then there were a number of other weddings as well, mainly of officers. I think there were one or two men who married like a cook who'd been in the camp, but officers and a few other officers and stewards all ended up married with children. And I've met the grandchildren of a few of them. So yeah, it was a very different life for the officers than it was for the men. Although there are stories of women lining up at barbed wire fences or the chain fences, hoping to kiss an Englishman inside.
Well, we often read about how war changes men and women who experience it. I guess these are kind of changes that these sailors on HMS India probably weren't anticipating when they went to war.
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. I mean, I suppose you accept that there is a risk, but I think anyone thinking they may end up spending 3 years or 3.5 years of their life in Norway, no, I don't think any of them were expecting that.
And not just learning to ski, but speaking Norwegian, adopting some of their culture, marrying Norwegian women. I mean, it kind of changed them all forever, I would guess.
Yeah, I think it very much did. But again, I think it's fairly similar with all. It seems to be so many people who have spoken to men who've come back from war situations. It just wasn't spoken about. My father-in-law keeps saying I know more about his father's time at war than he ever knew, because his father never spoke of it, didn't speak of his time in Norway, didn't speak of the ship going down. It was just not spoken about.
No, that's interesting, because I interviewed a few men who were British soldiers who were captured in the First World War, and they said that when they came back, people wanted to know about the battles they'd been in, but they didn't want to know about their time in the camp. It was almost as if that wasn't somehow part of the war. And I guess that would be difficult for men who were interned to kind of relate that to the derring do, you know, of Jutland or the Falklands or whatever.
Yeah, I mean, I did see something on I think it was on Who Do You Think You Are the other day with one of the celebrities talking about their relative coming back, and the relative had been in this kind of situation, had been interned. And I think it was by the Germans. And you know, he said, well, when they returned at the end of the war, how were they, you know, were they thought of as war heroes like everybody else, or was it? And they said, well, no, they were welcomed back as war heroes. But these men had seen 3 months of warfare as such, and then they were kept in a camp. And so I don't know. I mean, I don't know how they thought of themselves, when there was, I think, a lot of pride for many men had been in battle. Yeah, it was something that they had not done.
Well, I guess it's all part of the kind of myriad experience of war. So in 1918, as the conflict is probably increasingly obviously coming towards a conclusion, what happens to them, and what's their experience in that final phase?
So in that final phase, one of the hardest things for them was the Spanish flu hit. The Spanish flu hit the camp. And so just as men were starting to be repatriated home, two men died from the Spanish flu, and a whole bunch of them had to be kept there until they were well enough to travel again. But those who could go were put on ships back. Arnold, my grandfather-in-law, he went to Ripon repatriation camp and was there for a while before he was allowed to go home. And I think that was the pattern for most of them. They were sent to a repatriation camp for a while, and then they were allowed to return home. Most of them had one leave period that they were allowed to go back, as any soldiers were during World War I. They were granted leave for a period of time, and so the same was granted. There was a deal done with the Norwegians that these men could go home, so they did get a period of 2 weeks. They had to start getting strict on them because many of them found reasons they had to stay a bit longer. And the Norwegians finally said, no, it's 2 weeks from the moment they leave the camp till the moment they get back. And that's what they get. So I think they end up with about a week at home. So many, they'd been home in that time for 1 week. But yeah, the from what I can gather, they were repatriated to a repatriation camp and then allowed to go home.
So that leave then, they were allowed to leave Norway, go back to Britain, yes, see family, and then come back, yeah, to Norway to go back, yeah, into the camp.
Yeah.
Wow.
And one sent his brother back instead of himself. And that was picked up on pretty quickly. And both of them were sent to jail for a little while to think about what they'd done. Yeah, it was a trust-based thing that these men would return. But the Admiralty had, and the Foreign Office had made an agreement that the men would return to camp. But from my understanding, men who were fighting in other places were allowed these periods of leave as well. So I think it was a part and parcel of serving, and they were still regarded as serving, and so they were allowed their leave, and the Norwegians let them go.
Incredible.
The one thing that could have stopped it was the two men who escaped. So two men did escape the camp in 1916. They were working outside the camp for the officers, and they were given these armbands to wear. And so one of them was working outside the camp. He was given an armband. He stole a bike, stole another bike as well, sent the armband back into the camp, and his mate wore the armband out of the camp, and the two of them made it back to the UK.
Gosh.
And after that happened, things got a little stricter for those who were in the camp. And one of them didn't go back to war, but the other did and became quite a decorated. He ended up joining the Air Force and became quite a decorated soldier in both World War I and World War II. But in all the things I've researched on him, not one of them mentions that he was an escaped internee from a camp in Norway.
Gosh, fascinating. Mm. So with your only kind of personal journey with this, then you started with a family connection through your husband, and you've unraveled this story. I know people who listen to this podcast are always fascinated by this. Kind of, how did you do it, and kind of what did you find along the way, and what kind of material did you find?
So the first thing for me, I think, was working with Arnold's letters. I transcribed all of those, and then it was this journey of trying to find out what had happened to have other letters available in the market. And they were being sold for £400, £500, these letters. And it wasn't actually for the letter. It's for the sensor markings on the envelopes. Oh. So the philatelists. And I've been contacted 3 times in the past 3 weeks from people who found other letters. Somewhere around 1984, when the final sister died, a bunch of the letters were sold in an auction in the New Forest. And many of them were collected by a philatelist named Roger Partridge. And he started heavy research then into HMS India, into the internment camp, into Arnold. Now, unfortunately, he died, I think, 2 years before I started writing. So I never got to meet him. But then he sold the collection. So it's gone far and wide. And so I've got 53 letters that the family own. And I found another 41 that are in the wider, mainly philatelist community, which has been really interesting. So that community has given me a lot. And I've been in contact with quite a few of them. And I've got all of Roger's work has been given to me to use, all the research he did. And then I started looking at the lists of the men who'd been on board. And it was then a painstaking journey through genealogy sites where I started just writing to people saying, this man's on your family tree. Do you know anything about his time during World War I? This is what I know. And I found, as I said, over 30 descendants now of men who were on the boat. And I've got photos from them, and I've got, not firsthand accounts, but family recollections of their time on board. I've sat with the commander's granddaughter and had afternoon tea with her. I've had a beer in the pub with one of the steward's grandsons, and he lives a whole 10 minutes from me. It's been a fantastic journey. It's a really it's been really fun to meet all these people and to find the stories. And one thing that I'm finding from all of them is they're so happy to have this story told, because I've not met anyone who's not been a descendant who's gone, oh, yes, I heard of that. No one's heard of this story.
No, it's extraordinary. And I saw that you've along the way found quite a lot of photographs on your excellent website, which we'll put a link to on the podcast website. There's some amazing images of some of the guys who were from the ship.
Yeah, I've got some great stuff. It's the huts. Poor Arnold's hut burnt down twice in the time he was interned. So not only did he lost everything on the ship, but then he lost everything twice when his hut burnt down. So all of his letters that he'd got from his sisters and the things that he used to sit back and look through when he was trying to fill time twice got burnt down. There's some magic pictures, photographs of these huts burning down. There's photographs of the men themselves. There's photographs of dress-up, days, skiing, the work on the railroads. We've got photographs of all of that, the camp itself. Yeah, there's all manner of things. We've also got things like a program from a variety show they put on in 1918, which was another sort of attempt, I think, at the officers to, create a bit of interest in the camp. So there's all kinds of things that we've collected along the way. We've got some referrals. Arnold was written for working on the railroad. As I said, his sisters were fabulous hoarders. And thank goodness they were, because we keep finding more things from them tucked away in books, and it's been a really good journey. And other people have really added to this. Today I found on eBay some medals from a gentleman who'd lost his life, and I've been in contact with the man selling those. We've found boxes that were made by some of the men whilst they were interned, that are inscribed on the bottom of them are from the internees of HMS India. So all kinds of things pop up every now and then if you know where to look.
And if anyone's listened to this who's got a connection to HMS India, then they need to get in touch with you, really, don't they?
Yeah, absolutely. It's when I had the book published, I didn't self-publish, but I did pretty much as close as you can do using a vanity publisher, really, because I just wanted the story out there. But I'd be hoping in future I may find someone who can help me republish it well, and I've got extra stories already that I need to put in there from, people who've contacted me. And that's why I've got the website going and my Facebook page and things like that, is so that when I get new information, I can share it with people and let them know. I've had three new letters come in from Arnold in the past few weeks, so they're all going to go on the website. But that's the great thing about having those kind of places, is that you can keep the story going.
Absolutely. I mean, it strikes me as it would make a fantastic drama, considering some of the things that you've described.
Listen, I think it really would. I have sent it to a Norwegian film producer, but I haven't heard back from him. But I've always thought that there's so much in it. There's love stories, there's escapes from internment camps, there's a shipwreck, there's all kinds of things in there that I think Arnold's letters, giving that personal recollection of what's happening, there's a personal tale there being told. You're getting someone's firsthand experience from the very beginning to the very end.
And did your journey take you to Norway as well, to kind of see where
I was supposed to go last year? I was supposed to go to Narvik and then down, and there was a pilot strike. And we worked out it was going to end up with us taking, I think, 4 days to get to Narvik at the cost of very many, many pounds. So I'm going to say to my husband, my Christmas present this year, I'd really like a trip to Norway, please.
Or until they make the drama, then the production team can take you out there to have a look at it.
That'd be great.
Yeah.
Because the camp is still there.
Right.
There's one building left, but it's still used as a military camp. Even to this day. I've actually just been in contact with a gentleman who's bought my book, who lives in a neighbouring village. So, yeah, the camp is still there, and I'd love to see it. I really would. Two of the descendants of men on board have been close to the wreck site and have left flowers there. I'd love to do that. one of them sailed their own boat. I've got a boat, but I'm not sailing from Weymouth to the North Sea.
No, that might be a journey in its own right to write another book about, I think.
Yeah, no, I'm happier staying in local waters, thanks.
And I don't blame you. And presumably there'll be the graves of those who didn't make it back. They'll be buried.
Yes, there are graves in Narvik and in Bodø. And then there are some down near Lillehammer where those who died in the, so the men who died of Spanish flu are there. And then they're listed on the Plymouth, the Portsmouth and the Chatham memorials as well. Men who died are all listed on those ones too. So there are some, places around that you can see some of those men who lost their lives on it.
Well, I mean, this is a fascinating story. And, I thank you so much for kind of telling us more about it, because I think this is a great start to kind of looking at the war at sea. It's so important. And shouldn't really be forgotten in the way that I kind of feel sometimes it is with the First World War.
I think you're right. There's a lot of attention given to the trenches, rightly so. But there was other stuff going on as well, definitely.
Good. Well, we'll point people to your website and also your book. And there's links on your website to buy the book, I think, isn't there?
Yeah, there definitely is. There definitely is. And, available as far as, if you've got listeners in the US, it's available through bookstores in the US as well.
Brilliant. Well, thanks so much, Rebecca. Thanks for joining us. Thanks for telling us this story of HMS India and these amazing guys who ended up in Norway in a kind of forgotten part of the First World War.
Yeah, it's been a real pleasure, Paul. Thank you very much for having me on.
Thanks.
You've been listening to an episode of The Old Front Line with me, military historian Paul Reed. You can follow me on Twitter at SomCorps. You can follow the podcast at Old Frontline Pod. Check out the website at oldfrontline.co.uk, where you'll find lots of podcast extras and photographs and links to books that are mentioned in the podcast. And if you feel like supporting us, you can go to our Patreon page, patreon.com/oldfrontline, or support us on Buy Me a Coffee at buymeacoffee.com/oldfrontline. Links to all of these are on our website. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you again soon.